Welcome to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society, an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars dedicated to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about our annual conference, our journal Pietas, and more, visit ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Christopher Annadale, and this episode is one in a series focused on the theme of place, what it means to have a place, and how our rootedness affects our personal, familial, and social lives. On this episode of The Sower, our place is Ennis, Montana. And our guest to introduce us to Ennis is Dr. John Wilsey, an associate professor of church history and philosophy and chair of the church history department at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He is also a research fellow at the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, which is an initiative of the First Liberty Institute. He writes on nationalism, religious freedom, and conservatism in American history. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Chris. I'm really looking forward to joining you for this. It's going to be good.
That's great. You were one of the people who approached me to volunteer at the Ciceronian Society conference just a couple of months ago when I announced the idea for this podcast series on place. And so I'm interested to hear what you have to say about your background and your experience of Ennis, Montana, and the environment around it in terms of, you know, you becoming who and what you are today. Please tell us about Ennis.
Yeah. Ennis is a town in southwestern Montana. It's about 100 miles or so northwest of Yellowstone Park. You take the route that goes out of West Yellowstone, north on Route 89 North, and then you turn on to it on State Highway 287, or not State Highway, US 287, that takes you through past Hebgen Lake and north up the Madison Valley and into town. My family, on my father's side, the Wilseys, settled in the Gallatin Valley, which is one valley to the east over from the Madison Valley, in the 1930s. My great aunt and my great uncle moved to Ennis in the late 1930s after they got married. And they lived in the same house on a ranch just outside of town until they died. My great aunt died in 2003. And the Ennis cemetery, the town cemetery, contains the remains of many of my relatives. My grandfather is buried there. And my many great aunts and uncles are buried there as well. And still have cousins that live in Ennis. And when I was, I did not grow up in Ennis, but my father had experienced his first years in southwestern Montana, in the Gallatin Valley especially, because his father was a geologist studying those mountains and those regions of southwestern Montana adjacent to Ennis. They worshiped at a Episcopal church in the town of Jeffers, which is right next to Ennis. But my grandfather died of polio in 1949 when my father was about seven. And he spent his summers as a teenager working on the ranches in the Madison Valley south of town. And then when I was a boy and all the way through my childhood and teenage years and early adulthood, we would take many, many family trips in the summers to Ennis and see relatives and hike and backpack and fish and ski in the area. And so southwestern Montana had always made a deep, deep impression on me in terms of family heritage, and also the place itself, the local place itself, and the places in town and in the Madison and the Gallatin valleys.
Now, you live in and near Louisville now in the Midwest, a very different environment from Ennis. Do you have a kind of nostalgia or longing for there? Do you take your own family back to Montana sometimes? How deeply rooted do you feel there now at this stage in your life?
Still very much so. Still very much so. I took our oldest daughter, who is now 18, I took her on her first trip west to Montana when she was four. That was the age I was when I took my first trip to Montana. My father took me. And we've taken our children on many trips, many summers. They've spent many, many, many summers up, out there with my father. My father lives in Great Falls, Montana, which is about 4 hours north. But I still have family in Ennis who still live there. I have two sets of cousins that remain in Ennis and another cousin who doesn't live in Ennis anymore, but still lives in Montana and still lives close by. And she's there quite a bit. So yes, I have a longing for it. When I was a child and when I was in my teenage years and into my early adulthood years, it had always been my dream to live in Montana. I almost moved to Montana right after college, just with nothing in my, you know, with no money, and just drove out. It was almost drove out there, but I chickened out at the last minute. I was too scared to do it because I didn't have any prospects. I didn't know what I would do if I got there.
Where were you at the time?
I had just graduated from Furman University in South Carolina, and I was casting about for what I was going to do next. I ended up getting a job teaching at a small school in Virginia, but in the period between graduation from college and taking that job a few months later to start teaching in the fall of 1992, I very nearly just got in my car and drove west. I didn't do it because I just, it was almost like, you know, I'd say to myself, next week on Monday, I'm going to do it. And then Monday would come and I just couldn't do it. I was too scared to do it. But I still love it and still have a very close doubt. I do have one story I wanted to tell you about that. In 2000, this would have been 2007, I took a friend to go backpacking with me in the Taylor Mountains, which are right adjacent to Taylor Fork, which is a river. The Taylors are in a particularly beautiful range of mountains right between the Madison and the Gallatin Valleys, and spent all my teenage years hiking in those mountains, early 20s. So I took a friend with me. We were going to spend about a week backpacking in those mountains. And we flew into Bozeman, which is the airport you get to get to Ennis. We'd rented a car and we were driving down through Ennis to go to the mountains. We needed to stop and get some gas. And I wanted to stop and get a Coca-Cola at the gas station, which was a Sinclair station, I believe, right there on the north side of town, where US 287 and State Route 287 split off. You take State Route 287 off to the northwest to go to Virginia City, and there that gas station sits right there. Might be an Exxon. I can't remember which one it is now, but that gas station had been there forever. I mean, it had been there for as long as I could remember. And I got out of the car, and I went inside to get a Coca-Cola, and I walked up to the counter to pay for my drink, and it was an older lady behind the counter. And she looked at me and she said, "You must be a Wilsey."
That's amazing.
And I did not know who she was. I'd never met her before, never even seen her before. I said, "Well, I am. How did you know?" And she said, "It's your eyebrows." I have thick, bushy eyebrows. And that is a Wilsey family trait. All of our family have thick eyebrows. So I just thought that was so just a special thing that had happened. When I was 24 years old in 1993, on a visit that I was making to visit family, it was over the 4th of July weekend. And the 4th of July in Ennis is just a wonderful time to be there, because there's a town parade on the 4th of July, and there's also the Ennis Rodeo. Which is, if you want to go see a real rodeo, a real Western rodeo, you go to Ennis to see that. And I had the very, very singular, very salient opportunity to ride in the parade. I rode one of my cousin's horses in the parade and represented the Wilsey family and the Jones family, because we were some of the oldest families in town. And that was one of the greatest honors of my whole life, was to ride in that parade.
That's remarkable. It sounds like your situation with regard to Ennis is similar to that of many people, I think, regard to mine with relation to some of the towns in southeastern Nebraska. Some of those towns are disappearing now. They're in decline. Let me ask you this. One of the features of small rural towns, whether it's in Nebraska or Indiana, in Mississippi or Montana is that they do stay relatively the same. That gas station's been there forever. The people, families, the big families there are often pretty stable, same generation over generation. But one reason they don't change is because they don't get economically developed. They stay relatively poor or at roughly the same sort of level. We had a conversation in the last episode with Alan Mendenhall about economic development in the Auburn area and the sort of advantages and disadvantages of that. Is there a kind of time capsule quality to the place that you're talking about, that it's really there because it doesn't have the kind of wave of development and economic growth that we might associate with a large city like Louisville or Philadelphia? What are your thoughts on that?
The answer is yes and no. The sadly part of it is, when my father was a young man, was a working town. It was a ranch town. It was a cowboy. It was a cow town. My great aunt, my great uncle were ranchers. My great uncle was a lawyer, and he was a lawyer that had a practice in Virginia City for his whole career. But they had a working ranch, and their children, my cousins, my second cousins, my first cousins once removed, they were all ranchers as well. But that began to change after a ski hill was constructed, a ski resort called Big Sky, which many people know about. It's a very prominent ski resort today and has been for a long time. It was built in the late 60s on the slopes of a mountain called Lone Mountain, which is in the Gallatin Valley. And Lone Mountain is a strikingly beautiful peak. As you would gather from the name, it is it's a rare mountain because it stands completely unattached from any other range or set of ridges or any other peaks. It's very high. It's very prominent. It's very striking mountain. And in the late 60s, it was developed as a ski hill. At first, in the early 70s and then into the 80s, the ski hill appealed mainly to local people would go and ski. I learned how to ski at Big Sky when I was a young man. But by the time you get to the 1990s, Big Sky was attracting people, wealthy people, especially from places like California and places like Atlanta. In the 1990s, for example, Ted Turner, one of the richest men in the world, discovered Ennis and discovered the Madison Valley and purchased enormous tracts of land for himself. Steven Seagal, he was a famous actor back in the 80s and 90s. He bought a ranch called the Sun Ranch, which my father worked on when he was a teenager. And the Sun Ranch is still there. And so that's one way to answer your question. Yeah, there's still these timeless places, these landmarks that have been there for generations, like particular ranches in the valley, like the Sun Ranch. But there is a lot of development. My father, when he was a boy, and my grandfather was doing his geologic research in the Gallatin, they lived in sight of Lone Mountain before there were any people out there. There were no people out there, and they lived in a cabin that they rented a couple of summers there in the 1940s. It's interesting to hear my father talk about his childhood and reflect also on the development of the ski hill. He didn't like the ski hill there, and he didn't like to go there. My great aunt never went to Big Sky. She refused to go. She was personally wounded by the construction of that ski hill on Lone Mountain. Wow! So to talk to the old folks who remember the days before all the development, and to hear their perspective on everything that's happened now, Ennis has become this a very wealthy place, a wealthy suburb of Bozeman. A lot of celebrities, a lot of big money have bought up the ranches and a lot of lands out there. And that to me is sad because it's a sign of the commercialization of the place. Also, one other thing I'll say about that, in 1992, you probably remember a movie came out based on a novel, a very good novel called A River Runs Through It. The movie featured, what's his name?
Was it Robert Redford?
No. It was the second generation, the second coming of Robert Redford. What's his name? Married to Jennifer Aniston? No, he was, no. What's his name? Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt was in that movie. The movie is set in the novel. The novel's set in Montana. And the movie was filmed in the areas around the Gallatin and Madison Valley. And I noticed, I graduated from college in 1992. And I remember noticing that whenever I would go out in the summers and in the wintertime, I would fly from Atlanta to Salt Lake and then from Salt Lake into Bozeman. That was always what I would do. The flight that you took from Salt Lake to Bozeman was almost, well, before 1992, was almost always just half full. It was always locals that were going home. But after that movie, I never flew on a flight from Salt Lake to Bozeman that was not completely packed full of people. And everybody carrying their fly rods on the plane. Everybody wanted to be Brad Pitt and be a fly fisherman. That's when I noticed a real change. But if you talk to my great aunt, she would have said that the change would have happened in 1967 when they started building the Big Sky Ski Resort. So anyway, that's a long answer to your question. But there are some things about Ennis that are the same and have been, like the rodeo and the parade. My aunt had a funny story in 1988. I remember this from 1988. I don't know why I remember it so well because of that year, but it was 1988, that summer. I was spending the summer out there. And she was telling me that she had met a new young family that had just moved into Ennis from California. And they were in the grocery store and they were talking. And the woman said, my Aunt Joan said to the lady, you know, how long have you lived here? And she said, well, we've lived here for 6 months. We love it. She said, how long have you lived here? My aunt said, 50 years. And I just thought that, and she was, my Aunt Joan was had a very dry sense of humor. And so she said it with a deadpan kind of a response, which I thought was wonderful.
Sounds like a character.
She was very much so.
Reflecting on the fate of Ennis, it sounds like the story of a lot of places, especially rural places, and we might even say it's the story of the fortunate ones, where somebody does build something 50 years ago that turns the town into a desirable place to be. But it also seems to me, from the perspective of people who care about place and a sort of the kind of identity that people form based upon their places, there's a kind of tension here, of course, between the local and the particular, between the old timers, the families that go way back, the people that can be recognized from their eyebrows, for example, and the newcomers. And part of it seems to really hinge on, in ways, it's the story of modern America. It's the story of post-war prosperity. It's the story of the past 70 years of all the different parts of the United States with its economic system and freedom of movement. And if I begin to think sort of from the ground up about, you know, how could Ennis have been different? How could a place like Ennis be different today? I find myself thinking of things like, you know, is there a certain way of life that is typical of this part of the country, of its that emerges from its geography and its resources and that shapes its people? And then is there a way of governing that area, that locality, in keeping with that way of life? And sort of setting economic priorities and limits that would help to preserve that way of life. But of course, ways of life don't have voting rights. Individuals do. And so we have a whole set of assumptions about politics, about society, about freedom of movement, freedom of investment. Anybody can go to Ennis to spend their money to go fly fishing, even if they're inspired by a movie, and even if it, you know, perhaps gradually changes the character of the place. And to try to think of an alternate world where those things weren't allowed, where there were, I don't know, border guards around the Gallatin Valley. You can only come in, only so many of you can come in. It seems very un-American, or certainly contrary to the kind of freedom that we value today. How do you think about that kind of tension, if I've described it well?
I think that's a great description, and I completely agree. Montanans are very conscious of their freedom and their individualism and their ability to be self-sufficient and to also help each other, to help their neighbors. One thing that does sort of mitigate the growth and the development of Ennis and other places in Montana is that if you move to Montana, you have to be self-sufficient. You cannot depend on just being able to ride to the local Walmart or the local Home Depot to get lumber or to get some kind of supplies for a repair at your house or to fix something. You have to be able to be creative enough to do it yourself. If you're not able to do things yourself, if you're not self-sufficient, you're not going to make it. Because it's not just that the winters are cold and winters are long and they're hard, but distances are nothing like anybody in the East can relate to. And many people in the West in California just can't relate to the idea of driving for an hour and not seeing another human being on the road. That's more rare today in today's Montana, but in the 80s and in the 90s, and really up until maybe 20 years ago, that was not uncommon at all. So that is one thing that mitigates it, but it's an organic thing. It's an environmental thing, and it's a cultural thing too. People in Montana locals would be more than willing to help anybody who was a newcomer. But if that newcomer was too dependent, too needy, and in any way superior, they can't expect to find help of any kind from a local.
Yeah, that's interesting. That sounds like the place keeps its local character by welcoming newcomers and turning them into, eventually old timers. Might take certainly more than 6 months, might take a couple of decades, in fact, might not be till your kids or your grandkids are really from there, if there's a deep sort of familial investment in the area. What's your life been like now living as somebody, to return to the theme from before, as somebody who's living far distant from this place that your heart's deeply attached to? I mean, to go back is not to go back as a tourist, it's to go back as somebody who's really from there, but who lives, most of 1,000 miles distant for various reasons. How have you navigated that kind of tension in your own life?
There is a tension. On the one hand, I love to go back to Montana, and I do feel like it's going home. I was raised in Georgia, and I have a real strong attachment to my Southern heritage as well. But my father's family, the Wilseys, are Westerners. They're Montanans. That heritage I'm also very proud of and want very much to pass down to my children as well. Whenever we drive, we always drive. We've only flown as a family one time. All the rest of the times we've driven out west, we have driven. Because I want my children to see the country. I want them to see the land. I want them to see the people that live in the towns on the other side of the Mississippi River. And the closer we get to Montana, I don't allow them to read a book or to look at their phone or whatever. I want them to look out the window and see the sights. And I point out to them places that have meant a lot to me over the years. I love to go back to the mountains where I spent my childhood and teenage years hiking and backpacking and taking pack trips on horseback with my relatives. Going back a couple of generations, it's a family tradition to take a pack trip, the whole family, and camp. There's a good campground where we always camp. Not an official campground, but it's a place where we camp along a creek called Cache Creek, and it's in the Gallatin. One half of the group will come over the mountains on horseback, and the other half will bring in food and supplies and vehicles and set up camp and set up the kitchen and everything. And then we stay there for a few days, and then the group that came in brought all the supplies, they ride back. And the group that had ridden in, cleans up the camp and drives it out. And I remember doing that when I was 5 years old, and then I was able to introduce that to my children when they were young, back when they were, just little, like I was when I first went. I have a picture of my father and I was about 5 years old. My father and I were on a horse. The horse's name was Blue, and have fond memories. We all do in the family have these fond memories of Blue. And my dad and I are on that horse together. I'm sitting in his lap, and I still have that picture. It's framed in my house. And I have a picture of my youngest daughter, Sally, and she was, she was about five. And we're sitting on my cousin Lucy's horse. she's sitting in my lap, and it's in the Cache Creek campground as well. I cherish those pictures and those connections. At the same time, it's hard to go back because I have a theory about the way Americans view wilderness and wild places over their history since about 1820. Going from seeing wilderness as a barrier, or seeing wilderness as something to conquer, to seeing wilderness as sublime, sort of the romantic view of wilderness in the 19th century, to seeing wilderness as something to conserve and to steward, like Theodore Roosevelt, John Muir, people like that in the early 20th century. And then shifting over to our own day, where wilderness has become a playground. And wilderness has also been commercialized through big business. Outdoor recreation is big business. Ski hills like Big Sky, like Breckenridge, like Aspen, Vail, places like that. Stores like REI, Academy, that are nationwide, global, you know, and are multi-million dollar, billion, maybe even billion dollars. It's big, big business. Have drawn inordinate numbers of people to wild places and places that used to be a secret. Places that you could go to that were a family secret, even. And going to those places now, and they're overrun. The parking lots are full of cars. Their dogs go around and they crap everywhere. They're loud. They walk on the trails and they have a Bluetooth speaker and they're playing music while they're walking on the trail. Those things are heartbreaking to me. And they take away something of a spiritual quality of the place. And it's a heartbreaking thing. But as a Christian, I remember that it's a reminder to me that this is not my home. And even though I feel a really strong affection and a long affection for the places in Ennis and the Spanish Peaks and the Hill Guards and the Taylors and the mountains that I love and the Gallatin and Madison Ranges, those mountains don't claim me. And one day I'll be dead. My grandfather, who was a geologist, died when he was only 28. He loved those mountains. I still have his old slides from when he was a geologist and studying the formations and whatever it was he was studying as a geologist. And what's striking is those pictures he took in the 40s, they're the same mountains. They look the same. They look exactly the same. It looked like they could have been taken yesterday. And he loved them. But he died. And those mountains didn't claim him, and he can no longer claim them. And one day I'll die, and they'll lay me in a tomb. And if I place all my hope and confidence in these places, well, they're passing things. My home has to be elsewhere. I'm made for another world, like C.S. Lewis liked to say.
That's a beautiful way to put it. It sounds also like a kind of defense against the possible appeal of the sort of blood and soil nationalism that you see in Europe, concern for to love the place, but not to love it inordinately, and not to put your trust in the princes or the mountains of this world. That resonates with me, living as I do at the foot of the first run of the ridge of the Appalachians here in Western Maryland. I have one more question for you, if I might. We're running up against our planned time. I was thinking about your talking about your attachment to the place of your grandfather, the place of your father, though you've raised in Georgia and you have the accent to go with it. And then I thought to myself about the fact that, you know, certainly every generation experiences a kind of dilution, right? A kind of obvious material dilution of genetics. You know, my kids are half me and half my wife, but also my kids' places and ancestors are half mine and half my wife's. And I wonder, what do you see in your kids as they're growing up now about their attachment to a place like Ennis, which is not just for them dad's place, but granddad's and great-granddad's place, as well as, they have a whole branch of people and places on the other side of the family as well. Is that the kind of thing that you sort of see or feel becoming diluted, or can it be kept strong, and if so, how?
Oh, that's a great question. I love, yeah, my children have that. But on my wife's side, her parents still live in the same house that she was a child in. They moved to that house when my wife was two, and they still live in that same house. And You go into that house, it's like a time machine.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. So my children remember their early childhood, and they can, you know, walking into their house, the smells, what you see, the furniture, the things on the wall, everything looks the same. And I think that's wonderful. My great aunt Joan, her house was that way. And I could be gone for a couple of years and come back and it smelled the same and everything looks the same. And that sameness, you need that. A kid needs that. A child needs that in their life to know that in the midst of all the changes in the world, there's places you can still go to that are the same. My great aunt Joan had a marvelous rock collection. She has, and I have it sitting on my desk here in my office here at school. It's a big chunk about the size, well, you can hold it in two hands, of obsidian, which is a volcanic rock, black, jet black, shiny black rock. And she had it sitting on her front stoop by her front door for just decades. It had been there. I think she must have found it and picked it up in the 60s sometime. Because it was sitting in the exact same spot right by her door for my whole life. And when she died in 2003, I asked my cousins if they wouldn't mind if I just took that rock, because it was something to remember her by. And I have it sitting on my desk right over there now. It's a book, a bookend, like it holds the books. And my children, they still have something like that. They still have an anchor at a place. Back in Raleigh, North Carolina, where my wife is from and where she was raised. And I think that's very important. I think that's something that they don't appreciate as much right now. You know, when you're young like that, when you're in your teens, you do have a certain appreciation for it. But it becomes, as you know, it becomes much more special to you as you get older. And when their grandparents end up, you know, passing away and the house is sold, they'll think back to that house with very fond memories, I'm sure.
Thanks very much. That's a beautiful thought. I'm just imagining this stone of obsidian being this kind of semi-permanent thing, but maybe like our places, rightly considered, it's both more permanent than the kind of commercial flow of contemporary America, but also less permanent than our, you know, our eternal home, our final destination that we should always keep our eyes fixed on. Our place for this episode of The Sower has been Ennis, Montana, in the Madison and Gallatin Valleys nearby, and our guest has been Dr. John Wilsey of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been wonderful to be with you.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Sower, please share it with a friend and rate us 5 stars. Go to our website, ciceroneansociety.org, for more information about our activities and mission.